For the past 5 days, we have been bewildered because we have the world's mightiest army, yet the Pentagon was bombed. America is the world's richest nation, yet its greatest twin symbols of capitalism no longer stand. The president says terrorism will not stand, yet he does not know where the enemy stands. And we do not know how to stop random terrorist acts by suicide bombers. The destruction and death dwarf the loss of 2,400 military and 49 civilian deaths at Pearl Harbor. And then we knew who the enemy was and where to find them. Then the enemy was a nation rather than merely an ideology. For the past 5 days, we've been watching reality TV, and we've discovered that it's not about small groups of self-absorbed people playing contrived games in remote places. Real reality is about people who know in the depths of their hearts that no one is an island, and that the deaths of others diminish and frighten us as well. This is the bloody, almost paralyzing background against which we gather here to grieve, to harbor anger and fury, to weep, and to be with one another. And yet it is still a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability now more apparent than strength, and a peace that can pass understanding as it also eludes our grasp. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. It seems to be characteristic of us that when we try to deal with emotions that have gone to either extreme, joy or sorrow, that we turn toward verse rather than prose. Someone after the first service handed me a poem that he'd found that I will read to you, and then my own words for this are also some form of verse, though I'm not a poet. This is a poem from Edna St. Vincent Millay, and the title of it is Lament. Listen, children, your father is dead. From his old coats, I'll make you little jackets. I'll make you little trousers from his old pants. There'll be in his pockets things he used to put there, keys and pennies covered with tobacco. Dan shall have the pennies to save in his bank. Ann shall have the keys to make a pretty noise with. Life must go on, and the dead be forgotten. Life must go on, though good men die. Ann, eat your breakfast. Dan, take your medicine. Life must go on. I forget just why. It was so much worse than they said, so much more violent than we had imagined. Whoever tried to guard us from suicide and mass murder, why couldn't you have been stronger? Why must we see, hear, and feel this? Even when we spoke of the horror, we didn't expect this horror. The attack was more dramatic, the dead more numerous than we wanted to know. In so many ways, we would give up almost anything for the return of our innocence. We pray we may be protected from the demons that made those few throw their lives away, throwing away so many others with them. We pray we may be moved beyond the terror and into healing. Let this awful numbness pass and return us to life. We are so very fragile. So here in desperation and in determination, we fling this little prayer both outward and inward to all the gods and all the suffering souls who will listen, and we say simply, be with us. Amen. respond to the violence of September 11th? My first response, which may have been like many of yours, was fury. I wanted vengeance. I wanted war. I wanted someone else to suffer. It was blind, deep, powerful fury. Now we look around 5 days later and we see that that is an emotion that's being tapped into by leaders and by the media, and that the country seems to be getting whipped up into a militant nationalistic fury demanding a bloody revenge. Maybe we'll respond that way. How should we respond? It's hard to know, though it's suddenly very clear how we should not and will not respond. We should not and will not respond as Mother Teresa did when Union Carbide flew her to Bhopal, India, after their chemicals had killed 2,000 people, made a donation to her charities, and she told the press that all she had to say for people to do was just forgive, forgive. We will not respond that way, and we should not. And I think we will not respond in the key of the Christian teaching of turn the other cheek. I've heard no ministers suggest this. I can't imagine it. Turning the other cheek rewards and encourages the violence that awakened us in the first place. We may respond by proof texting from an older reading, the text about demanding an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, a body for a body and blood for blood. And that seems to be what we're being whipped up into as a nation right now. I hope we don't respond that way, but our past history suggests that we may. When I look for teachings that seem to offer a realistic kind of light, the one that comes to mind above any others is one from Confucius. 2,500 years ago, Confucius taught that we should repay good with kindness and that we should repay evil with justice. I think that's how we should respond, but it doesn't solve anything. For what's justice here? Last week I asked what truth was, and suddenly that question seems pale and intellectual compared to the question of what justice would be for our society, for those who were killed, and for other people in the world. When we talked about what truth was, in many ways it was easy to talk about. We knew that truth has to be whole, has to make us more alive and more whole, has to connect us with more people, with bigger parts of the world, has to go beyond our parochial boundaries and our parochial biases. Truth has to be something with some decent claims to being universal or at least global. I think justice is truth, power, and love combined and acting at a distance. And so justice has to be able to make the same claims. Now I'm having emotional trouble with making this next transition. You may too, so let me at least name it. To talk about what justice or truth could mean means to back off from something that it feels too soon to back off from. I don't feel like backing off either. I'm still angry. But if we're going to look for a way ahead, I think we have to back off and be willing to look at what happened Tuesday, not only from our eyes, but from the eyes of people who see it very differently than we do. So I ask your forgiveness if I back off too far and too soon from a subject that still feels too emotional to think about. This was not an attack on freedom and democracy. It was made very clear what the attack was on. They chose their symbols carefully and aimed precisely. This was an attack on military power and policies and economic power and policies of which we are traditionally quite proud and which many others in the world hate. Whether we agree or not with their attack, and I think it was an unconscionable, cowardly, disgusting, and despicable attack that cannot be defended from any moral framework. But I think to move beyond it, we need to try to understand how people who see this very differently may see it. To us, our Pentagon is the symbol of the mightiest military power on the earth, one that we associate with proud ideals, one that we say upholds justice and virtue and goodness and the principle of law. Many others in the world don't see it that way. To many others, it is a symbol of terror and oppression. We see the more than 5,000 people who were murdered Tuesday, and we say this is an outrage, and anyone with an ounce of humanity has to feel outraged by it. And it's true. Others say yes, but the list of outrages that are beyond the pale of human toleration is much longer than this. They talk about a Gulf War in which we destroyed the water purification capabilities of a country of Iraq, and where we then controlled through embargoes for the next decade the ration of chlorine and other chemicals that could have been used to purify the water and kill the waterborne diseases. Diseases that have now killed an estimated 1 million Iraqi civilians, perhaps over 500,000 Iraqi children. And they say, where are your tears for these people? They point to our invasion of Panama in violation of all international law and remind us that our army shelled the poorest ghettos in Panama City for hours while broadcasting demands for surrender in English rather than Spanish, and that we then bulldozed the 4,000 dead, mostly civilians, into an unmarked mass grave. And other voices in the world say, was not this also terrorism? They point to our, so far, uncritical backing of Israel, of the fact that we have stood against the consensus of world opinion, which says that Israel's occupation of the West Bank is illegal, and that a Palestinian state must be established. They point to that and they say, you claim noble ideals, but you only seem to obey international law when it suits you, and when it doesn't suit you, you flaunt it at will. And many people believe these are not the acts of noble people. These were a few of the angers that boiled over into the hatred to bomb the Pentagon. The list could extend through other South American countries, through tiny islands we've attacked, through African countries, all the way back to Vietnam and perhaps earlier. But it's a list sung in that key. It's a distinctly minor key. But those who attacked us don't believe that this is primarily about military power. They believe that it is primarily about economic power. That this is about an American economy with plans to redefine the world's economies toward the direction of third world economies, two-tiered structures between the very rich and the very desperate. They can point to examples of this from all over the world, and they wonder why we don't see them and why we don't care. Why don't we care that our $130 Nike tennis shoes are made by children in Asian countries where they're paid only pennies a day? Why didn't it bother us a few years ago when we learned that Michael Jordan was paid more for promotion by Nike in 1 year, $25 million, that was more than double the wages earned by all workers in all tennis shoe companies in Asia combined? Many people remember this and ask, where were our tears and where was our heart then? They say the signs of this economy and this economic restructuring are obvious even in our own country, and few want to look at them. Even in our own country, when workers are laid off, stock prices soar, and the pundits on television news say the economy is soaring with it. When workers are returned to work at minimum wages, at lower wages, and without benefits, and stock prices soar, and the bonuses to CEOs soar again, they say, do you think these are coincidences? This is the plan being worked out in front of your eyes, and you will not have eyes to see or ears to hear. These are some of their hatreds that drove people to attack the World Trade Center, to destroy the twin symbols of American capitalism. So how are we to respond? One response is to bomb Afghanistan back into the Stone Age. We may try. The problem with that is that it's already been done. The Russians took care of that a while back. The Afghan people are poor people without an economy, without hospitals, without schools, without an infrastructure. All that's been done. This wasn't done to us by the Afghan people. One former Afghani wrote, I don't know whether this is true, but I suspect that it is more true than not. One Afghani wrote that to think more clearly about Osama bin Laden, the Taliban, and the Afghan people, we should think of Osama bin Laden as a Hitler, the Taliban as Nazis, and the Afghan people as Jewish prisoners in concentration camps, who were the first victims of this deadly combination of power, not their allies. So we may bomb Afghanistan. We may also start campaigns of ethnic and religious terror. This too seems to be happening, where we try to turn Caucasians against Arabs and Christians against Muslims. You're already hearing these voices. Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, they're so easy to confuse. Those two have talked in an interview that's been printed in the paper about the Muslims need to accept Christ into their heart. That all liberals are to blame for this. All uppity women are to blame for this. Everyone who ever had or contemplated an abortion is to blame for this. All gays and lesbians are to blame for this. That this is God's judgment on an America that hasn't obeyed God's rule. And so this God they pray to slaughters 5,000 innocent people as a sign. It's not a God worth praying to. It's a God to be terrified of. What else we might do, and it looks like we're gathering steam for it, is to crank the American people up for a massive and prolonged military attack everywhere. Our enemy is not a country this time, it's an ideology. It's people who know they cannot match our military power and know that they do not need to. They heard about Vietnam. They know that we have still not learned how to fight a guerrilla war and how to respond to terrorists who are willing to die for what they believe. They don't need to outnumber us. They just need to keep hiding, being an invisible target, and launching periodic terrorist attacks. Let's look at this, to be as cynical as I can get this morning. Let's look at this as though the critics are right when they say this is about economics. This is about restructuring economic structures in this country and throughout the world. And let's look at a massive military operation from the standpoint of economics and ask what it would do and what it would serve. We'll begin removing individual freedoms and democratic rights under the mask of military necessity. You have already heard Lawrence Eagleburger and other former leaders saying that we need to do this. They said this attack happened because we're a democracy and we may have to give up some individual rights. We could look to Ireland and to England as countries who have opposed terrorism without forfeiting individual rights, but the threat is there that we will. The massive outlay of money takes $50 or $100 billion out of the money that could ever be thought of giving for education, for benefits, to help empower and lift up poor people. This too can be done very cleanly and smoothly under the guise of military necessity and national defense. Even Social Security can be raided under the guise of military necessity. From an absolutely cynical standpoint, massive military retaliation could be an extremely shrewd and effective tactic. I'm not optimistic. This may be the way we go. But there's at least one other option worth considering. It doesn't cost a lot. It empowers not only our people, but all the people of the world. It seems realistic because, in fact, it's been done. It's a lesson we could learn from Ireland. We spent decades suffering under terrorist attacks of both directions. And then in 1998, when a car bomb went off in an open market, killing several dozen innocent civilians, somehow something snapped, and the Irish people said, enough. They weren't saying, enough of the terrorist acts visited on us. They were saying, enough of all terrorist acts, including those by our people. Extremists on both wings have tried to break the peace process in Ireland since 1998. So far, they've not been successful. Saying enough meant that they will not tolerate or aid or harbor or hide anyone planning any violent terrorist attacks from any side. So far, that's working. If we had the courage and the vision to say enough and mean it in that way, we could begin empowering not only our own people, but people all over the world who have surely seen enough by now. It would also mean refusing to tolerate and abide the terrorist acts of our own country, and those form quite a long list. Will anyone in our leadership or our media ever present this as an option and try to educate us toward taking it? I don't know. But I'm reminded of a Buddhist story from the samurai culture that may offer us some wisdom. The samurai swordsmen were known for two things. They were known for immense skill with a sword, and they were known for using that skill only to uphold causes of the highest honor, never lower motives. This is a story of a samurai warrior who was on a mission of honorable vengeance, vengeance against someone who deserved honorable vengeance. And he finally had the man cornered and was prepared to kill him with his sword. And the man walked up to him and spit in his face. The samurai sheathed his sword and walked away. Because once the man had spit in his face, he knew he would no longer be killing him for honor. He would be killing him out of anger. And that's not honorable. Now, I do not mean for a second to imply that what happened to us Tuesday was on the same level as someone spitting in our face. It was vile and it was despicable, and I don't for a second mean to demean it. But what happened to us Tuesday has moved us to want to respond from anger and vengeance rather than from honor. And to do that is to diminish us and to diminish the world and continue the cycles of violence and vengeance, God knows how long. What will we do? I don't know. At this point, all I have are prayers, and that's my prayer.